Because what I got to say is, live from Campbell.
It's Saturday night!
Restrooms are located. I'd like to introduce the speaker for tonight and briefly talking to him. He seems like he's an okay guy. He's from some place called Antioch or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, his name's John M.
I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. I want to welcome the new people. It's been a while since I've been in this room. I moved up to Antioch. And I had a friend of mine say to me, he said, you know, you're probably one of those guys that drives 75 miles to talk and wouldn't go across the street to listen, you know? So I did. And I'm down here to share tonight. And I am an alcoholic. And I didn't have any idea when I'd open my mouth and say those words what it really meant. The first time I said them, I choked on them almost. And it was in St. Luke's in Las Gatas on a Friday noon meeting. It took me a lot of years to get here. In more pain than, you know, you have to be an alcoholic to understand it, you know. And when I look out across the faces here and you see people that have come to these rooms and they stand up for the first time and I say, I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. That's the beginning. That opens the door. And hold on to your ass because here we go, you know. Anyways, I didn't drink much as a boy. I came from a family of seven kids in Boston, Roxbury, and it was a, let me say, if they said it was lower income, they're shitting, you know. I mean, we were poor. If it cost 50 cents to go around the world, I couldn't afford to go across the street, and I knew it. Had a well-educated mother and a very bright, intelligent father. He was a hard-working man, and then he'd disappear, and you wouldn't see him for weeks. And the kids, very, very early in age, we learned how to get out and hustle. And, I mean, not just hustle for spending money, was for food money, clothes, and we kind of made adjustments. But you never talked about it. Nobody ever said to the mother and the family, you know, that son of a bitch. But we said it to each other. And it was a hate-love relationship because he was a neat guy when he'd sober up. But if he stayed sober for a long period of time, he became one mean, nervous son of a bitch. And I never understood that until I tried to get sober a few times on my own. But anyways, I didn't have much use for alcohol. And it wasn't a very fun situation. It really is a family disease. It affects everybody. And also, I understand a little bit now, the children, the non-alcoholics in the family, or the non-drinkers, affect the alcoholic as well. They all feed on each other, you know. But anyway, I had my first drink when I was about 13. I really wasn't all that drunk, but it was an exhilarating feeling. I felt powerful. I felt like I belonged, and I exaggerated being drunk. But I felt the freedom, you know, freedom from care, freedom from worry. But I was very destructive in that first drunk. It was up in New Hampshire. A bunch of us were sleeping in a barn of a family friend that had us up for the summer. Kids from my neighborhood. And we just tore that goddamn place apart, you know. And the next day, the lady looked at us and she said, you know, I don't understand this kind of destruction, you know. Here we've had you here for most of the summer. And we fed you, we clothed you, we cared about you. And this is how you repay us, you know. And I thought, and I felt sick about that, a soul sickness inside. I thought, Jesus, to be a part of that. Well, anyway, by the grace of God, and I'm going to cut a long story, not a big long drunkalogue tonight here, but we got out of Roxbury, and we got out with about $200 and nine people in a big seven-passenger limousine, a 41 Lincoln, and we headed for California in 51. And it really was on my brother's mustering out pay from the service. And he said, let's get out of this goddamn dump. Dad, my father got sober long enough and he listened. We packed up with the clothes on our back and we landed in San Diego because we had friends there. Anyway, make a long story short, when I was a small boy, I said to my mother, one of the first times and only times I ever talked about the father's drinking, I said, I'll tell you what. And this is after knowing what it was to go to bed hungry, cold, and sometimes with the shit knocked out of you for nothing. And I said, if I ever had kids, I'd have enough kids to be hanging from the chandeliers. I'd love them. I'd care for them. And I would not be a drinker. Everything that I said that I wouldn't, I had become, you know, just like the Father. But anyways, there's something that when you're I don't know, come from the beginnings where I came from, money was important to me. And I made a vow that someday I'd become a very wealthy man. And I hit Silicon Valley just about when it was clicking off. I had owned a few small businesses in San Diego from a very young age. I met my wife in the course of a business. She was a small town, San Diego was at that time, personality on TV. She traded at the garage I worked at. And her mother owned race horses, and I bought a horse. And I hadn't drank much. But people thought I was older at that time. I was like 18 or 19. I owned my own business. People assumed you were 24, 25. And I never told her the difference. We started dating. And one of those dates was the first time I drank. It was before the date. I was very nervous. It was to go to El Cortez in San Diego. And it was with... was up in the sky room or wherever that thing was. And I was really nervous and going. And I knew exactly what to do about it. I stopped in the bar. First bar in my life, other than Shining Shoes in Roxbury. I went in, I sat down, and a guy said to me, "Good evening, sir." And I loved him right away. "You're right. Here I am. What would you like?" And I said, "The best." He said, "We got it." He slid it out there. I put the money out. He never questioned me about my age. And I took that shooter, and down it went. And it was hot, warm, and I felt powerful. Give me another one. I had about 3 or 4 or 5, and off and running I went. I went to that function, and the guys were older, sophisticated guys in out in the business world. And Lenore, my wife at that time, said she was ahead of the promotion department. And I thought, where the shit did she get this one, you know? And I heard that remark, and it was her boss that made it. Anyways, he went into the men's room. I went into the men's room. He was sitting on the throne, and he really literally got the shit knocked out of him, you know? My first evening drinking was violent, and from there on, 20-something years later, it got worse. And I was very helpful with the police trying to find the guy that did this to him, you know. To be an alcoholic or to be involved in that Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde behavior, you had to be an actor. You had to be an actor. But I didn't know until years later why such a rage could come out of me. When I was a kid and I lived in that area, you didn't screw with the McCracken kids. Every one of us, you know, my father used to put us in the basement. If you had a grudge, you slugged it out. And if you want to see a vicious, violent fight, you'll watch two brothers fight one another with a hate. And I'll tell you what, you learn how to fight or you're going to die young. But anyway, the close of that evening, Lenore had said to me, she said, "Were you involved in that?" I said, "What? What are you talking about?" I said, "I went to arrest him. I'm the one that found him, you know?" And anyways, and to this day, and I don't think I've ever told her, but anyway. I went broke in that business. And I went broke for two simple reasons, inexperience and alcoholism. One of the things was I could work, I worked my ass off. 12, 13, 14, 15 hours a day was normal. I would work longer hours than that. And I'd just get to the point when things would go good, and I'd time to go ahead and relax, have a drink or two, or somebody invite me someplace. And I was like anybody else. I had no intentions of getting drunk. I can remember going out with my bookkeeper. We were approximately the same age, body weight. I cared about my children. By that time, we had 3 or 4 little kids that came around, one right after another, you know. And I would go out for a drink, and I'd show up a day or two later. I would drink until I couldn't stand it anymore, and I'd sober up. I wasn't into the marriage 2 or 3 years with a few kids, was quite successful in these small businesses, and I had to go into a sanatorium. I went into a deep depression, and I wanted to die. I just wanted to die, and I didn't realize until I got sober in AA to know some of the things about alcoholism. When I got sober, I was one miserable son of a bitch. and I was depressed. I went in and they said, we know what to do. We can help you. They put me into electrical shock therapy, which was fun, you know. I've had all kinds of different things, and nobody ever asked me that I can recollect, you drink a lot. People ask me if you drink. Yeah, I drink occasionally. That was true in those days, occasionally. But when I drank, it was volumes of it. I used to take a half a pound of hamburger, a quarter of a pound of butter, or 2 cubes of butter. And because I was so disgusted with my body, I felt my body would let me down. I didn't drink as a man. I couldn't hold my liquor. After 30, 40 drinks, I get sick, you know. Or so I need a little liner. You put a cube or two of butter down there, half a pound of hamburger, and shit, you're all right, you know. You got something. Oh. And that's how when I knew I was going to drink, because I didn't want to embarrass my wife. I didn't want to be ashamed. I was very careful when I'd feel that numbness come, and I couldn't see my face, and go into the bathroom or look into the mirror, and you couldn't see anything. You thought, shit, it's time to go home, you know. But anyway, lost my train of thought. Alcoholism, that disease of alcoholism, progressed over the years. I went broke in San Diego, came up to Silicon Valley, and the best man at my wedding was a little painter, James Wesley Watkins. And him and I, he was a little bit of a guy. He'd go out to start the fights, and I'd try to finish him, you know. But the reason I hung around him, because he played a guitar and he could sing. God, that guy could sing. And the beer was free. You know, shit, we go from bar to bar, honky tonk, and we picked the biggest guy in the world. And like I say, he was small. And anyways, was pretty wild and pretty fierce. And my wife a number of times said, I can't stand this. I just can't stand it. Being a good husband of sound mind and a good father that didn't want to lose his family, I knew exactly what to say to her. I'd say, I tell you what, you go out that door, try to make it on your own. I knew exactly what to say to a woman that had 3 or 4 little kids and was pregnant. That financial insecurity, you know. I won't help you, you know. And it terrified her. And it kept her locked in as a prisoner into this crazy, bizarre marriage. It was bizarre because when I was sober, I did care. And I cared when I was drunk, you know. And then I couldn't care anymore, and I was just an asshole, a wild man. But anyways, I come up into this area, and I said, it'd be different. And I was introduced to one of the guys that started this industry that blew this in as a mechanic. That's all, you know, and a machinist. And I got into as a foreman in operations and so forth. And again, I tried to rebuild our family, our life, and I worked my ass off. I became known in the industry as the guy that knew how to put factories together. And I've been around for a long time, and pretty soon I found it. I was helped found a couple of companies, and I made a considerable amount of money. And I worked my ass off, and it's still the disease, lugging that disease. We all think because you're an alcoholic that you have to be underneath a bridge someplace. Most alcoholics are functioning people. They have families. They have loved ones. They have homes still, and still lugging this disease of denial. Nobody ever mentioned to talk to me about alcoholism. I ended up with a joint venture in Ireland, of all places for an alcoholic to go. Oh, shit. I try to drink Ireland dry, you know? I love those guys. They say an Irishman's a 7-course meal in Ireland, and I understood it. An Irishman would crawl over 6 nude women to get to a beer, and then a 7-course meal was a potato and a 6-pack, you know, and that was about it. But we were very successful. We put a factory together. Life was good. My children were happy there. Took the whole family there, and before that, I had lived in Germany for a while, Switzerland. I put factories there, put one in Japan, and had everything going for me, except I was still struggling with this disease over the years. It's just like you build everything up to the point where life was good, and then tear the son of a bitch down right to the nubbins. We moved back to California here. And decide I would run the home office out of California, be different. After my children, I lived in Limerick, used to have to come find me on occasion. And I was a pretty visible guy there, you know. It was like a big frog in a small pond. And when I got drunk, the whole town knew it. I can remember my wife coming home from tears in her eyes and said, I'm just sick. can't even go out to a grocery store. And the Irish, I'll tell you, and as a whole, are pretty gentle, loving people. They really are. But if they give you a zinger, man, you've been had. She went into a butcher shop one day, and she said, "I'm Mrs. McCracken. I ordered this and this and this." And he says, "Oh, yes, Mrs. McCracken, the wife of the lady, the wife of the man that thinks he's single, you know?" I used to have, and the truth was, there's a lot of things that happen while we drink and so forth. But the truth was that I had a hotel room that I kept year round, though I had a home in Ireland, in a home with the family. And she wondered why I had that motel room. And the reason was, and I couldn't tell her, and I couldn't admit it to anybody, was in Ireland, the bars closed at 11. If you were a resident of a hotel, you could drink 24 hours a day. And they didn't have liquor stores or package stores like here. And if you needed to drink, you had to have a place to go. And all this time, my wife thought I was lugging something to the room. I was. And alcohol. And I said I never hid bottles. I know how I used to get rid of the bottles out of that room so they wouldn't talk. It was a hotel where all the flights came in from all over. And Aeroflot, the Russians, came in here as well. And they went zoom right to their room. They didn't mingle or mix. And what I would do is take my empties and I put it out in front of the room of the captain, you know? And that's how I hid my empties. And they used to come to me and they'd say, "Be a good man, don't do that. You're causing us trouble. That guy gets pissed off." And I say, "I don't know what you're talking about. It wasn't me." When I come through customs used to call me Tinkerbell, because I wouldn't come through with clothes in suitcases. Man, shit, I'd empty the duty-free shop and I'd be lugging booze, you know. But anyway, I drank my fill of it, and we hit back here, and we were here in 78. And make a long story short, every good alcoholic should own a bar if you can afford it. I owned a bar locally here, had all the time while I was in Ireland, and it gave me a reason to be in a bar. I had to go down and check on it. And I did some of my heaviest destructive drinking. And I knew from years past that the best way to get in that house is to be more angry than that woman, and she'd be frightened of you. So all the way home, I'd be thinking, she opens her mouth, I'm going to go right through the ceiling. I'd get up into the front driveway, and how I'd come through that door is I'd kick it open. And she'd say, "What's wrong?" I'd say, "You wouldn't believe the day I had, you know?" And she'd take one look at me, and she knew, just leave him alone. I was in kind of a drunken stupor that night, and I had a moment of clarity when she walked in about maybe 6 in the morning, and she looked at me and she said, "That's it. I want you out. I can't stand this. I'm in so much pain. I don't give a shit what you do. You can take all your money and you can put it where the sun don't shine. Just get out of my life." And I believed her. I knew she wasn't kidding. And the truth was, I loved this lady. I always was in love with her. She was my one and only at that time. And silly to say this day and age maybe, but I was a cherry when I got married. I worked hard. And I never knew another woman. She was my very best friend. We went through business after business, and she helped me in every one of them. She encouraged me. She did a lot of things. And she became my adversary. I got so that I hated her. She would go off to her side of the house, and she would weep and cry. I can remember one time in Ireland, I came home drunk, and I was on the floor. And she said to the woman next door, she went to get some help, to lug me in the house, get me out of the weather. And she said, "Look at that." She said, "That heap in there was a quiet, loving, caring boy that I married, and a gentle person." And she said, "Just look at him." And what went through me when she said that was, "Screw you, you bitch." The anger. And I knew I was through. And something flashed that night. I looked at her and I seen her swollen eyes, and I'm very grateful. There's a lot of other abuse you can do, you know, besides physical abuse. That wasn't part of it in the marriage. But the verbal abuse was terrible and cutting and vicious. And her eyes were swollen shut almost from crying. And I knew what to do. I picked up the phone. I called AA. And she was out of the room at the time. And how did I know about AA and why it's so important that we talk to each other and we share with one another? We have hospitals now where we don't see many wet drunks come into meetings, you know. But this is 12-step work with just your presence here. And my brother 12-stepped me, and I didn't know that. 3 or 4 years before that, he got sober before me in San Diego. He was in the sheriff's department down there, just recently retired. They used to send a SWAT squad out for him. He was so violent, and to get him. And he was sober, and I had come back from Ireland on vacation or something, and I stopped in, and I heard he wasn't drinking. I thought, shit, I don't want to see this son of a gun, you know? Jesus. So I bought a six-pack of Coke or something over there, you know, and I thought I didn't want him drooling or anything, and I went over there. Shit, he was pleasant, and the first time he wanted to kind of communicate to me and talk to me, he genuinely was concerned about me. And he asked me about my drinking, and right away I bristled. Reminded me when the first time anybody ever talked to me about drinking was in Mountain View. Almost 20 years before that, I came home drunk, fell asleep on a sofa, and a cigarette fell beside my leg. And I passed out. And it smoldered for hours. And the couch caught fire. The robe was on fire. I woke up and I shook my leg and I thought I had a kink or something, or a Charlie horse. I hung the burning robe in the closet. I left the sofa on fire, and I went to bed, you know? And I was a social drinker, you know? So after 3 or 4 days, there was a Dr. Bill O'Donnell in the Glara Medical Group in Mountain View. I went to see Bill, and I knew him. And he looked at that, and he said, "My God, what did you do?" Because it was a hole in my leg, and it was at least about 1.5 to 2 inches across, and it tapered in. And he said, "It looks like a acetylene torch did this." And I said, I burnt myself with a cigarette. With a cigarette. He said, "How much were you drinking?" And I got angry. He said, "There's no way in hell could any human being fall asleep and have this happen to them. You have to be anesthetized," he said. "John, how much?" And then I get pissed off. And I said, "Hey, I'm not here for a lecture. Fix the leg, you know?" And he kind of bristled a little bit. He said, "Okay, son of a gun, you know? We will." I went home, and my wife asked me, "What did the doctor say?" I said, and I had the answer. I said, "He said, quit smoking." And I did, you know? So 20 years later, here's somebody else trying to talk to me. And this time, I bristled just as much. Matter of fact, I was more defensive, and I was angry. I looked at him like some wacko when he belonged to some Christian thing. He disappeared into meetings, and he was a goofball and this and that. But he said 3 words to me. He said, "You know, I'm an alcoholic, John." And I thought, shit, I could have told you that, you know? Big deal, you know? And he said, "It's a cunning, baffling, powerful disease." And I'll tell you what, that night, or that morning, that moment of clarity, that's what rung in my ears. I never considered once me having been an alcoholic or a disease. I knew nothing about that. We never spoke about it, about my dad's problems, just the results of the trouble. I called AA, and I told my wife about half hour, 45 minutes ago, I said, "I think I got a drinking problem." And I just called AA. And this lady looked like, "Oh, shit, what next, you know?" Alcoholics, if you're like me, you know, we just seem to go ahead and be able to rebound. It's like the ninth inning, two outs, three men on base, two strikes, three balls, and the alcoholic comes to plate and he hits the home run. You think, "Oh, shit, not again," you know. Always some way to hang into the relationship. How can you throw the bastard out now? He's really trying to do something, you know. But God really has a sense of humor. He didn't send just some little cream puff to go ahead and 12-step me. With little Mike, he had about 12, 15 years of sobriety. He was one tough little guy. I used to be an automobile mechanic, and I went to be a president of a company, this and that. And this guy had an ego bigger than all hell. I was down on my knees, and that's the time to talk to an alcoholic when I call. But by the time he saw me, a day or two later, I thought I was a little hasty. And he kind of put a hook into me. he said, "Hey, I'm not sure if I'm going to have wheels or not when I go to this restaurant, so be there. At least you can give me a ride home." And I found out later that was full of shit, you know. So I got to the restaurant, and we sat down, and the guy told me about alcoholism, but he did it in a very unique way, I thought then. He talked about himself. And he got me to admit to some of the same things and the feelings I had, in that I wasn't some kind of I thought I was a maniac or some kind of a mental problem, you know. And a lot of times I was very, very, I was sure that was the problem. There was something wrong with me. And I can remember going to Mass in Ireland on occasion, and I'd say, "God help me." And I didn't realize it would come in the form of a little mechanic. But anyway, he put a hook into me. He sat down, he talked to me, and he said, "Well, a guy like you," he said, "I don't like your chances." And I thought right away, because I'm kind of a competitive guy, "What do you mean you don't like my chances?" He said, "Well..." He said, "A guy like you," he said, "you think you're," he said, "I take one look at you and you think you're above it all. You're a sharp cookie. You got all the answers. And I'm going to tell you something right now. This is a disease. It's a killer." He said, "It doesn't kill you instantly. It takes a long time. And the alcohol," he said, "if you cross that line, and I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, this is a disease that you go ahead and you will able to judge for yourself whether you're an alcoholic or not, but you come to a meeting." We went to the first meeting 2 days later, and the way he got me to the meeting was he was the secretary. He told me he was out of coffee. He called my office. He said, "Bring 5 pounds or 2 pounds, whatever it was," because I had no intention of going to the damn meeting. And he said, "And it's at St. Luke's, as you know," and he hung up the phone. I thought, "Oh, shit, you know?" Because, you know, it was just that one little second. That's all we have sometimes. And I'll tell you what, it isn't much. And if you work with a new person, it's just that 1 second. That's all you have, that moment where we're receptive. And he put the hook, and I showed up. And I went in there, and I looked around at the people. They looked nice. And it was mostly women, a nudes meeting. I thought, well, I always like talking to little ladies. I had tons that used to work for me and all this shit, you know. And he said to me, "Hey, you better sit down and listen." And what I heard then, and I know what he said to me wasn't much, but my thin was so skin. He told me, "You're probably one of the sickest ones I've ever run across." He said, "You're so sick." He said, "You're one sick son of a bitch." You know, I thought, oh. He said, "Why don't you sit down and shut up?" He said, "God gave you 2 ears and 1 mouth. Does that tell you something?" You know? And I was crushed. I was hurt. I thought maybe, you know, when I went to AA, I would see longshoremen. I'd see tough guys. They tell you how they stave off the booze. You know, guys that go ahead and shave by pounding the beard inside and biting it off. I didn't want to be in the room with a bunch of little housewives, you know. And this guy was terrific. He put a pin in me. You know, something happened. When the same feeling of remorse and the same feeling of self-disgust, I don't know how many times I get up and how many times I've had two or three times a gun in my mouth, gonna pull the trigger in a few times and had no idea what was wrong with me. I felt the same revulsion for self well up inside me. And I'll tell you, if you ever feel that, listen to it, it's good. It's God telling you, hey, shut up and listen, you know? And that feeling came up and inside me, I said to myself, you know, I made a commitment then. Why don't I just, for once, shut up and listen? And I sentenced myself to AA, literally at the time. I didn't know what you had. I didn't know if I wanted it. But I knew I didn't have the answers. There was one part of me. And I made a commitment. And anyways, and he made sure the commitment was kept. And you know how he did this in sponsorship? He involved me immediately, not just to meetings. He called me and he said, "Hey, I need some help." I thought he was broken down on the side of the freeway or something. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I got to go talk to a guy." "Well, what do you need me for? Come on, just come." And I went to my first 12-step call. And I looked at that man. And you know, there's all degrees of, if you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. There's no such thing as we know a little alcoholic. But I hadn't gone to the point of physical the way that man had. His legs were swollen, open sores. and he was worried about more other families and stuff like that. It was my first one. And Mike said to me, this guy would more be in touch with you probably than with me. And the guy asked me how much time I had, and I had 2-3 weeks or something like that, and he was impressed. When we say somebody stands up and don't ever, you don't think time doesn't mean something? Huh. Talk to the guy that doesn't have the time. By the grace of God, we have it. But when somebody stands up and says, hey, I got 30 days, the other alcoholic goes like this, and we just think it's terrific if you got a day, because we know what it is not to have that time. And that guy was impressed. My 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 calls, because he worked nights. He knew I was in an office. He knew I owned a company. And he just leaned on me because he knew how sick I was. He just involved me. And something happened. And I just say it like I feel it is. I feel that it's when you touch another person's soul and you know the depths of despair, and you can tell them there is a solution, there is an answer. I didn't have a step there. I hadn't done anything yet in the program. But I knew that by going to meetings, I wasn't drinking. And then he sent me off on a call, my first one by myself. And I'll tell this and I'll get on with a little further and how wonderful it is now. But anyway, what happened was he sent me, said, hey, this guy is a cream puff. You don't have to worry about it. He always told me, don't go on a 12-step call by yourself. You never know what you run into. He said, I've talked to this guy 2 or 3 times. He shouldn't give you any trouble. Right? Uh-huh. Thanks, Mike, you know. Anyways, I went to the door, and I was having a lot of problems with the program here. I was very angry. I was very violent. I would go to a meeting. I'd feel good. My wife and kids, when I'd come home, they'd say to me, how was the meeting? When I was here, I was saying to you, hey, hi, how are you? No, I'm feeling great. It's working. Come back. You know, it's everybody's best acquaintance, right? And I was saying that, and I'd come home, they'd say, how's the meeting? And I'd say, wasn't worth a shit, you know? I couldn't admit that it was, you know, I didn't know how it was working or why it was working, but I wasn't drinking. And I still owned that bar, and I was bartending nights, and I didn't lick a finger. And for me, man, that was a miracle. Never licked a finger. Anyways, I get up to the front door, and I should have had a clue. There was bullet holes. There was hatchet holes. And I knocked on the door, and a guy inside said, who's there? And I thought, screw you. A-A. Ah, shit. He said, who sent you? My sponsor sent me. And I thought it was like open sesame. You'd open that goddamn door, whatever. I thought I had the power of God with me. And I didn't realize. The truth was, I did. I really did. Because we have no power. He opened the door, and he had a gun. And it didn't concern me. That's how sick I was. He was my type of guy. I understood a wild, violent guy like that. Because I had guns, and I shot up things. Thank God I never shot anybody. Anyway, I looked around the house and all the bullet holes, and I looked at his TV, and it was a console, and I see the bullet holes around the cabinet, and he never shot the picture tube. And I thought, this guy's full of shit. He's just crying for help. So I said, hey, you're a pretty good shot. He said, yeah, I am. I said, let me see the gun. I looked at it, and I said, I'm a better shot than you. And he said, how's that? I said, watch me hit the picture tube. You don't shoot my TV! And I knew then that this guy, all he needed was somebody to grab him. I took the gun, we went for a drive, I fed him 5 times, he puked 5 times, and I hung out with him for a day till I could get Mike to him. And I just babysat him. Anyways, I think he's still sober today. 3 or 4 years later, he called me on a Christmas Eve. What a gift that was. I got so sick in this program. And I did. I got sicker emotionally. I think we overuse the term. It's just my opinion. Mental illness. I haven't seen too many mentally sick alcoholics. What I see is emotionally sick people, you know. And there's the problem where the emotions are so powerful that we've been denied. I know if I was ever hurt by a brother or anything else, you don't cry if you're a man. You don't cry. And what a wonderful, beautiful thing it is to cry. To go ahead and shed a tear. God gave us that ability to relieve the emotions. That's like telling your son or daughter, don't take a leak, you know? Another body function. You know? to deny a wonderful body function like that. I came into this program a broken, broken man in many, many ways, all on the inside, so broken I could never put me together. Slowly but surely, I got involved in the steps out of pain. Jack H. told me, you know, do you think you're tough? And I thought, no, not really. Inside, screw you, I'm tough, you know. And I always mouthed the people-pleasing things. He said, well, the first step's not a big thing. It really is. But that kicker, the powerlessness, the unmanageability didn't bother me too much. But I didn't, to tell me I was powerless, I didn't want to admit that macho thing. He asked me if I thought I had a chance against Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali at the time. And I said to him, no. And I thought, bullshit, I probably could take him a few rounds, you know. And I wasn't ready. Absolute pain. And he said, and I ended up in Good Samaritan Hospital, and I was in intensive care ward. And I had a slight stroke. I had a 200 over 100 and something in blood pressure, and the doctor came in to me, and he said, Jesus, you're killing yourself. We've gone all over you, and I want to tell you, stress management's not it, kid. You're like a volcano. And I said to him, for the first time, somebody outside the program, and I was choked up, I hadn't cried. I screamed and punched steering wheels, punched out windows, and knocked doors through. And I couldn't tell anybody at meeting level how much pain I was in. And I said to him, I'm an alcoholic. He said, oh, shit, is that all? Do you have a sponsor? And I said, yeah. He said, what's his name? And I told him. And he said, what's his number? And I told him. And he said, let me call him. And he got a hold of my sponsor. And it's, God, it hit me right then. I'll tell you what, it was such a big moment because the thing I was most angry at that time, I was mad at God. Why do I have this goddamn disease? And I was fighting it. I was angry. You son of a bitch, kill me. I don't care. That was my attitude. And the guy came and he said, just let go. There's no big deal being an alcoholic. It's a wonderful thing. You're going to find out someday. And I want to tell you, people that are new and have an experience, it is a wonderful thing. And you know why, huh? There is such a way of living that you've never dreamed of. There's a way to go back. And I mean, you're not going to go erase everything, but you can go back and make amends. You can go back and do many things. But most importantly, you can go forward without heaping any more shit on yourself. God doesn't make junk. I went through the rest of the steps, and I sat down on a Christmas Eve, and it got to be my fourth step. I lugged around in the boot of my car, underneath the tire, you know. And I had a guy here. I was president of a company. I couldn't even read the book. When he asked me to read the fifth chapter, I couldn't even hardly do it. And he sat down and he piecemealed the fourth step for me. He told me to go ahead and write on the first thing was resentments, then anger, then sex. And he'd look at it at meeting level. I'd meet him at a meeting. He'd say, okay, you did it, or you didn't, do this, do that. I finally had it all together in about 4 or 5 weeks' time. And I went to his home, and it was Christmas Eve. And I sat down and got eyeball to eyeball with him. I told him who I was and what happened to me. And there was two or three things I held back. I'd tell nobody. And he asked me, he said, have you told me everything? And I said, yeah, I have. And he said, no, you haven't. I want to tell you something right now. You did it too easy. There's always one or two things that we hold, and we think we're going to handle ourselves, and it's going to take you right out there, right in the bottle again. I sat down and thought, screw it, I'm going to tell him. And I told him. And he sat down and told a few things about himself. And then he said to me, and it scared the shit out of me, I thought, this guy has no idea how crazy I still am. Because he said to me, in a very short time, these things are going to be all over AA. And I thought, oh, you're dead. And he looked at me, smiled, he was playing with me, and I hesitated, and I'm so glad I did for him and for me. And I said, how's that? And he said, because you're going to tell him. You're going to tell them. And you know something, it was no big deal. I find out I'm not a big deal, you know. And nothing that ever happened in my life hasn't happened to you. Guys and gals are the same. We all hurt the same. We all love the same. little difference in plumbing, you know. No big deal. But we are. We're all God's kids. And I'll tell you what. I have had the opportunity to go through a lot of things sober, more so than I could ever. Thank God that I got sober and I had this fellowship, this amount of things. I'm no longer married. A marriage of 27 years at that time ended. It's okay. Went through a cancer. It's okay. Went through and lost all those businesses, down to lost Cadillacs, Jaguars, home in Saratoga, driving my famous sponsor's little 65 Bald Mustang. And it was okay. Today, what is it like, huh? My life is full. And if you think that you can go ahead and go through this program or life without experiencing pain, that's what got me here. I didn't want to ever experience pain. I want to be in La La Land, you know? Go ahead. And the truth is, AA, don't tell the new people, come in here, this is the pink cloud. This is reality in reality. And we learn how to deal with reality. We become responsible. We become responsible people. I know for my part, I took every single meeting I ever went to, except the ones, and I'm going to say this here, and this is only my opinion. I don't know how many times I used AA not to be a responsible father, not to be a responsible husband. When that wife said to me, I need to talk to you, I said, I got to go to a meeting. Zoom. Out the door I went. We don't come in here to hide out. AA, for me, has given me the ability to go out and face life on life's terms, and I still screw up. I don't think you ever, I just feel like I scratched the surface in the last few years. I've gone through some of my toughest times in my eighth and ninth year, you know. I'll be 10 years pretty soon. And I'll tell you what, it is a trip that I find the longer I'm around that I can take no credit for. It really is the grace of God. I have a brother that didn't make it here that's dead. And I'm sure God didn't love me any more than he loved him. And I don't question while I'm here. It's like a wonderful, wonderful, precious gift. You walk in the door when you're brand new. And believe it or not, you got everything in the first day you walk in. It just takes a long time to discover it, you know. All you got to do is say yes, you know. What's the big deal of being an alcoholic? You know, it's a big deal to be a sober alcoholic because I tell you, that's God's work. We've got three different prayers that AA doesn't really have a prayer, you know. But we have some direction that we're given in the big book. We talk about the third step prayer. It's so interesting about the prayers. They talk about this, and I didn't like this right away. And I was kind of a giver. I thought I was a lot. I was pretty generous in a lot of ways, and for whatever reason, I won't get into. But when I heard it was a selfish program, I thought, shit, that used to, you should help people, you know. But I want to tell you this. It is a selfish program in a very, very precious way. I'm in AA for one thing only, and I want to tell you, it's for the rewards. And that's what? Why would you ever want to do anything hanging? It's for the rewards. You go through all this shit, and you're hanging in no matter what. Broken homes, broken relationships, all the pain of the human being. And you know what? You hang in there by the grace of God. You don't drink. You go ahead and even out of the most painful situations, out of the ashes, you know. And you do find new understanding, new levels of love, new levels of understanding. AA is a give program, but you can't give it away unless, number one, you take care of yourself. AA comes first, and that's not activity. Families are important. Jobs are important. Being out there in society, being a member, a full part of society. AA principles come first. And the way I stay in touch with those principles, I go to my meetings. I stay in touch with other alcoholics. I sponsor, and I am sponsored. I love this program. I love you all dearly. And don't ever, ever let anybody tell you you're no good, especially yourself. You are good. You're worthy. And you know, if you don't think one life doesn't make a difference, huh? Bullshit. Just one little guy gets sober, and he sat down and he talked to me. He took the time. He didn't just go ahead and make the 12-step call and disappear. He did those follow-up calls. He put a hook in me. He kind of chased me. We say, well, shit, the son of a bitch wants it. Let him come get it. Well, maybe you do that after a point in time. But I'm so thankful he took the time for me. And I'm so glad you took the time to listen. God bless you all and thank you.